I didn't want it. You wanted it. Now you've got it. You don't like it. You can't get out of it now. Pork and beans, diapers to wash, too poor for the movies, too tired to love. There's nothing we can do. Hot stenographers on the subway, the grocery boy's got a big one. We can't do anything about it. You're only young once. You've got to die when your time comes. That's how it is. Nobody can change it. Guys in big cars whistle, freight trains moan in the night. We can't get away with it. That's the way life is. Everybody's in the same fix. It will never be any different.
The voice of Kenneth Rexroth, recorded, Lawrence, did you say sometime in the 50s?
I think so. 58, perhaps.
58, at the Black Hawk in San Francisco. The voice of Kenneth Rexroth will be with us for a long, long time, because here at Pacifica we have so many programs from Kenneth, his regular book reviews, his autobiography, many, many readings, and conversations with him about poetry, about everything. I wish we had the many phone calls that he made to the station. They were some of the most extraordinary experiences of conversation and delight you could imagine, but they were unfortunately, I think, not recorded. But the occasion isn't a happy one. Kenneth has been sick for quite a while, and we learned today that he died yesterday. Some of the worst kind of prose reaches us with the barest facts, and just such a bulletin reached us this afternoon, and I'll read a portion of it as follows. Kenneth Rexroth, a poet, critic, painter, and godfather of the Beat Generation, died of a heart attack at the age of 76. His literary agent told us this on Monday. Rexroth died at a suburban Montecito home at 8 p.m. Sunday after a year's illness. A native of South Bend, Indiana, Rexroth had exhibited his paintings at one-man shows throughout the United States and in Paris. He had studied at the New School, the Art Students League, and the Art Institute of Chicago, the recipient of national and international awards for his poetry. Rex Roth wrote poems, plays, essays, histories, and an autobiographical novel. At his death, he had been at work for about a year on a second volume of his autobiography, which was described as fairly complete and published after some editions. Rex Roth had served as the San Francisco correspondent for The Nation magazine and as a columnist for the San Francisco Examiner and was co-founder of the San Francisco Poetry Center. That tells very little about the whole story. And with us here in the studio this evening are two major poets, not only known in San Francisco but throughout the world, who knew Rex Roth very, very well, Michael McClure and Lawrence Ferlinghetti. And they're going to talk about his work and read some of his poetry. And it's about the best we could do this evening. We don't certainly feel like doing anything else. Rex Roth was, of course, very close to KPFA. He was here from the very beginnings. In fact, this afternoon I found a very brief portion of an account of Rex Roth here at KPFA by Ruth Hirschman, who is a very close friend of Rex Roth, and this had come up to us from Los Angeles.
Kenneth Rex Roth, one of the leading poets in the world today, and also one of the founders of Pacifica Radio, back in San Francisco in the 50s, in the days of its beginnings. Kenneth was one of the people who, along with a group of other pacifist intellectuals, I suppose you would describe them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's rather accurate.
He's listed in a couple of books of significant anarchists in American history as well, as a matter of fact.
Right. Banded together and decided that there had to be some kind of alternative in presenting new ideas, and hit upon the idea of founding a station that was listener-sponsored and non-commercial and therefore could offer ideas that were possibly not having a broad mass appeal but had a distinct minority appeal and would be free from censorship. And mm-hmm. Kenneth Rex was one of the people who was in on the very beginnings of Pacifica Radio.
They say, how does he happen to get in at the beginning of so many of these things? He was in the Chicago Renaissance in the 20s, mm-hmm. and then he was in New York in the 30s, and he was in Frisco with the City Lights and the Beats,
that's
Beat
right.
Movement and things like that. And he doesn't happen to bump into them. He starts them. And just like
right.
he did here at Pacifica, he one of his main philosophies of life, if I can use such a phrase, is to give a meeting place to the creative community.
And right. I think it's important, too, to remark, Ed, that Rex Roth has been one of the pioneers, really, of a whole group of poets and a whole sensibility in the United States that followed after him. He was, it's an irony because, of course, now he is teaching,
mm-hmm.
And he is a professor at a university, but he was one of the early poets in the United States who had a vision of the poet that, could one say, was possibly more French in a way, was the poet actually in the streets. He was
yes.
not an academic poet.
That's right.
And he had a vision of a poet who lived among the people, and in fact, I think he was one of the people who was responsible for creating a new lifestyle for poets in the United States, a non-academic lifestyle.
There's much, much more to the story, and we're going to hear at least some of it this evening. I'd just like to mention Mariana Rex Roth phoned this afternoon to announce that she knew there were many, many people who know and Rex Roth up here who can't get down to Santa Barbara. There will be a memorial service this coming Sunday at 1:00 at Holy Trinity Orthodox Cathedral on Green and Van Ness in San Francisco. That's 1 p.m. The Holy Trinity Orthodox Cathedral, Green and Van Ness, in San Francisco, a memorial service for Kenneth Rex Roth. Well, Lawrence and Michael, how far back does your recollections of Kenneth go? You were with him from the very beginning, weren't you?
I didn't arrive in the Bay Area till 1951, and my real education began with Kenneth Rex Roth on KPFA.
Really?
It really did. I mean, I was a politically naive, semi-literate, even though I had an MA from Columbia and a doctorate from the Sorbonne. But he did not just, as you know, review just poetry. He reviewed books in all fields, and I learned an enormous amount on many subjects, astronomy, geology, mythology, or any subject you can think of, practically. I went first to his house about 1953, and he had Friday night soirees in San Francisco. Sooner or later, practically every poet that was active at that time showed up at his house. I remember I sat in the corner for about the first year, not daring to open my mouth. This was, as far as I was concerned, he was much more important as a critic and translator than Ezra Pound. That was my experience in the 50s with him.
I can recall going up to his apartment to get his programs and staying for hours, and, as you say, learning a great deal. How long have you known Rex Roth?
Well, I guess I met Kenneth in 54. Kenneth was certainly, when I arrived here in 54, and I think maybe Philip LaMantilla was the first poet I met, and Robert Duncan or Kenneth Rex Roth was the second. And in a sense, Kenneth is the one who brought us together for that Six Gallery reading when Allen Ginsberg first read Howell. I'd met Allen, that was 1955, but I think of Kenneth as being the center, the pivot of what happened there, because I knew Allen, met Allen at a party for W.H. Auden when he read at the Poetry Center here early in 55. And then in the meantime, Kenneth Rex Roth had introduced Allen to Gary Snyder and Philip Whalen, who got to town and were visiting. Then we all got together for that Six Gallery reading. So he was the pivot for that, and he introduced us at that. And by that time, I was already going to these soirees that Lawrence was talking about. Lawrence, is that where I met you for the first time, I wonder?
Probably was.
I think so. Yeah. Another thing about those soirees, now that we're mentioning them, is that I remember meeting everybody there from Caress Crosby, who was the widow of Harry Crosby, to Malcolm Cowley. And I wanted to say something else where Lawrence was talking about Kenneth as a teacher or as an educator. He not only showed me what Kropotkin anarchism was like in the sense of mutual aid, but another thing that he taught me that I think was important, because I was a kid coming out of Kansas and I felt open to charges of exoticism if I followed my natural tendencies, and they were to look to the east, to look to the orient, and it was Kenneth who would back us on that and give us courage to realize that we belong to the Pacific Rim, that we belong to the Pacific Basin, that we did face the Orient, and the fact that we loved those Oriental languages and we loved that Oriental poetry and history and art was something he backed 100% and gave me the framework for standing on that.
I want to hear you two talk something about him as a person, as a man, about his tastes and about the way he lived and about his whole sort of, you know,
he was
his passion for life.
A stubborn son of a bitch. Well, he had a way of irritating your mind. And I think at the beginning of the program, you quoted from a New York Times dispatch on his death.
Yes.
And it called him the godfather
of the beat generation.
I think it would be more proper to say the gadfather, as in gadfly, of the state and of poets in general and intellectuals in general.
I've got a favorite anecdote about Kenna that it's not on the cantankerous side, it's on another side, because you're sure right. On the cantankerous side, also, he was a man of such brilliant eccentricity that I believe everybody I know had an imitation of Kenna. And at parties, sometimes the whole party would consist for an hour of people doing their imitation of Kenneth, and each one was different, and yet each one was a facet of Kenneth's personality. But a story about Kenneth, like a real thing that happened to me, was that all my life as a kid, I'd loved the paintings of Morris Graves, the fantastic Pacific Northwestern surrealist painter. And the very first thing I saw, the very first time I went to Kenneth Rexroth's house, were these incredibly beautiful pastels by Morris Graves that Kenneth had tacked on the wall with thumbtacks, unframed, at the right height so that his children, who were then, I think, 3 and 5, could see them comfortably. Mm. And they were thumbtacked to the wall, and the corners of, they'd been thumbtacked down so many times that the corners of the painting, or the corners of the pastels, had crumbled away. And I was shocked, surprised, and converted to the fact that art was really to be enjoyed. And right. that I, since to this day, I hate to frame something, and I prefer to thumbtack it up. And my daughter's too big now, I don't have to thumbtack it at that height, but that was, it was a great delight to me.
Is there something similar to the way in which seals were stamped on Chinese paintings, not Japanese, just about anywhere? They were carefully placed on there. I understand the Japanese didn't do that. Maybe the thumbtacks holes have added a certain artistic value to the work.
Also, I think Kenneth's pastels were as wonderful as Morris Graves's. I don't think too many people have seen those. You probably saw them. Something you might do is describe what it was like to walk into that apartment where it was books from Florida.
Is this the one on 250 Scott Street?
Yes.
How about
yes,
the one out on the avenues?
Well, the door downstairs opened automatically, didn't it? You rang the bell and suddenly the door opened and there was no one there except a long stairway. And then you walked up, and I remember the first time going up to meet this a frightening man. I heard him on the air. I'd never met him to get his program. And there at the top stood Rexroth in the semi-gloom looking down. And I must say, I was very surprised. He was terribly nice. He was very friendly. And I guess he saw I was shaking a little bit. And I walked through all of these rows and rows of books in old packing cases, went up to the ceilings, and got seated down. I think I was offered something. I forget what. Something to drink, probably. Spent the next several hours listening to him talk.
I remember one trivial note, but it kind of reveals the sort of humor, the kind of, and the fierce sort of old feeling that Rexroth had. And that was, he conducted a feud with Doubleday. Doubleday would send him books for review, but at that time, I don't think they do it now, but at that time they stamped on the flyleaf of the book, a stamp, you know, lettering.
Review copy.
Review copy. And it made it impossible for Rexroth to sell the copies of the books that he got for review. And since he got hundreds of copies of books, you know, he couldn't possibly review them all. And he was not being paid by this radio station, which never pays anybody. So that this was his chief revenue from doing the programs. And he, week after week, he waxed indignant after this. I don't know whether he ever got Doubleday to stop doing it, but he certainly waged a hard campaign.
Well, I hope you do a program with Tom Parkinson about Rexroth.
We certainly
wish you were here tonight. And in place of Tom being here himself, I'd like to quote from the book he wrote. I think it's in the case book on the beat that Tom Parkinson edited. He said in there his first impression of Rexroth, which was more or less mine in the first days of going to his apartment in the 50s, was that Rexroth gave the impression of sometime during the Kerensky regime having left the fledgling Soviet Republic to stagger on by itself.
That's really good.
Some of Kenneth's stories about his friends and other people were amazing to listen to. They were staggering in the scandalous way he spoke. They were all very funny, and I don't suppose there was too much truth in them, but you always suspect.
Well, that's why Doubleday insisted on his autobiography being called an autobiographical novel.
Yes, I read that.
The amazing thing about Kenneth's wild stories, though, is the small number of times that one was able to disprove a claim.
Because you weren't there.
Well, yes, that's right. There were a
when
few
he said
where
he met
Gertrude
Stein,
that.
You know, then you figured out the dates he was talking about. You realize that Kenneth was 2 years old in the suburbs of Chicago.
Oh, yes, but then
just
something
the right
would happen and Caress Crosby would come to town and then they would reminisce about the time they spent together with Stein. Not that they did in this case, but I mean, that kind of thing would happen. Mm. I'm going to read a couple of short poems of Kenneth's.
Yes.
Because I think something to remember about Kenneth is he died at 76, as you said from that press release. In the next to the last book that he wrote, and he must have been very close to 70 when he wrote this, Kenneth was always a fine poet, but there are some poets. Poets don't really have to lose out, like a physicist or a boxer. A lot of poets really come to in their late age, and I think Kenneth is one, and I think this poem is appropriate to this occasion tonight. This poem is called Suchness. In the theosophy of light, the logical universal ceases to be anything more than the dead body of an angel. What is substance? Our substance is whatever we feed our angel. The perfect incense for worship is camphor, whose flames leave no ashes. I think
his flames leave no
ashes.
Yeah. Ashes.
Yeah.
One of his early books was The Phoenix and the Tortoise.
Yes. Yes. There's a recording of him reading that poem that we have somewhere. When we put together a more elaborate program, we'll include
that. It was only recently that I learned, utterly by accident, that the four magical animals of the Chinese were the dragon, the unicorn, the phoenix, and the tortoise. And Kenneth's two long poems are called The Dragon and the Unicorn and The Phoenix and the Tortoise.
He was an extraordinary poet, I think. I've read some of his plays, and I think they're superb. And still
Greek refined plays?
Yes. He's not only brought in Far Eastern ideas, but also the tradition of Western ideas in Greek culture. Those plays are remarkable. Incorporations of some of the mythology of the earlier days with contemporary significance. He once loaned me a copy of his plays, and I dare say I never returned it. But I hope to put it to good use before too long and have a reading of some of the plays, at least one or two of them, on the station.
Well, bringing in that leads me to emphasize that he, coming from Chicago and establishing himself here, he brought San Francisco literary world out of its provincialism. I mean, he was an international...
He brought modernism to San Francisco, that's true, and linked it with the tradition that was already there.
Was there any resistance to this?
I don't know. I wasn't here in the 40s. There was a Circle magazine here in Berkeley, I know,
yes,
which was
right.
The first real international publication that I knew about that was published out here.
Von Duncan and Spicer were here, and Parkinson was here. Broughton was here. Matty Gleason was here.
Yes, I get the idea that in
the thing that we're forgetting also is that there was the anarchists who were kept at
that.
Walport, among whom were the anarchist pacifist conscientious objectors in the Second World War, among whom were Bill Everson, who was known as Brother Antoninus for a long time. They were imprisoned at Walport, and they they got furloughs. They'd come down to San Francisco, and a lot of those people moved to San Francisco at the end of the Second World War, and then that added to the stream of what was here. You must know a lot about that, Fred.
Yeah, well, there's a direct connection, of course, between that and the founding of this radio station.
Uh-huh.
Because this radio station could be said to be born, I think, in the
Lewis Hill was one of those COs.
Yeah, in the conscientious objection camps of the Second World
there
War.
There were printers like Adrian Wilson.
Right.
Was Dave Coven
there? Danny Wiltshire.
How about Dave Coven? Was he there?
Roy Kepler. Who?
Roy Coven.
I'm not sure about that. But there is a whole bunch of the founding brothers and sisters at KPFA. Of course, they were mostly brothers who were in the CO camps. But it's an interesting part of the station's history.
Yes.
And Rex Roth was right in the middle of it.
The poetry and jazz thing began to develop. You were part of that, weren't you, Lawrence?
Rex Roth had an idea to do poetry and jazz at the Cellar, which was a little club on Green Street in North Beach, San Francisco. And his idea was to widen the public for poetry, which it did. And it was the beginning of many years of poetry and jazz, most of which was terrible, I thought. But Rex Roth was certainly the instigator of the whole movement. The one poem that still holds up from that, from those poetry and jazz sessions at the Cellar is Rex Roth's Thou Shalt Not Kill, an elegy on the death of Dylan Thomas, which was on one side of the Fantasy Record, Poetry and Jazz at the Cellar, which is still available. And I hope you play it one of these days.
If I could get my hands on a copy, we said.
I'll bring you one. This Thou Shalt Not Kill is... there's no more ferocious castigation of modern society anywhere in modern literature. It's a violent, vituperative put-down of the man in the gray flannel suit, as Kenneth saw as being the epitome of the worst in American life, which he saw as killing the poet in everyone.
He's spoken of as an anarchist. To what extent was he an anarchist in everyday life, in his views?
I think
nail down what that is exactly.
Well, let me change the subject just a little bit, because I'll come at that in a slightly different vantage point. One of the things, remember, we're talking about the early 50s. Well, I mean, Lawrence can talk about the early 50s. I can talk about the mid-50s. And one of the things that Kenneth was preaching in those days was the value of the Aboriginal and Native poetries. I remember I had not heard anybody talk about Eskimo poet, Eskimo song before, or heard anybody saying that when it said lyric, it should at least have the potentiality for being sung. Also, Kenneth was the first person that I encountered who spoke of the classic poetries of China, like of the very, very early Chinese period, the period of Taoism, of Confucius, and of the early Japanese poetries. And in the same way, he spoke of the early Greek poetry. So I suppose that's all Bronze Age. Poetry.
Bronze Age poetry.
And at the same time, he emphasized our real body in the real nature that we lived in. Was the first person I saw who made an emphasis on bioregion, on our connecting ourselves physiologically by going out and walking and hiking and seeing and experiencing it.
Well, Michael, tell me, how was it that a guy who came out of the Midwest, out of South Bend, Indiana, became this polyglot, this amazing sort of collection of
interests. He must have been pretty amazing by the time he got here. Maybe Lawrence would have some idea.
Yeah, do you have any sense of that, Lawrence?
I don't know.
What led to that?
Jay Laughlin, who was Kenneth's publisher at New Direction, says that Kenneth has a photographic memory, which is the basis for a lot of the extraordinary scholarship that we saw come out of Kenneth.
Yeah. Well, also, he spent a lot of time in Europe, in Paris, and was well acquainted with, I guess, the world of poetry in that whole milieu before he came out to the West Coast, didn't he?
It's true. He was translating Reverdy and Artaud. Sorry.
How do you feel about academia?
Well, Kenneth the Don Quixote attacking the windmill of what he called the Corn Belt Metaphysicals, meaning Robert Penn Warren and that bunch.
Yeah, another phrase, the Belch End. chew, belch and chew society?
Yes. Yeah, I seem to remember angry remarks.
I think we owe a lot of our nerve to Kenneth's being in the vanguard with his
scissor bills. They're all scissor bills. That was a word of his.
Right, right.
At the same, he also didn't have any use for Ezra Pound.
He was one of the first.
he Rexroth felt that poetry should sing and try and sing one of Pound's cantos. I mean, just he really saw himself, I think, as Pound's competition and much more powerful than Pound. And I came to view him that way too. And he had a much better political position. I mean, he was completely opposed to Pound.
He had a pretty hopeless view of the social situation, didn't he? Or
what view? What kind of view?
Of the political scene. There's a great deal of sadness and hopelessness in some of his lines, but I wondered how extensive this was in the way he saw the world. He was
That's
bitter.
Funny. I
he
think of Rexroth as being idealistic and utopian.
Yes. They go so closely together. you can express the darker side and
If you look at the dragon and the unicorn, or the phoenix and the tortoise, you find that here's this these travel poems and in this odd syllabic count that he used. I think it was eight syllables to the line, or was it seven syllables to the line? Composed dozens and dozens of pages in these long poems, which became links for the free movement of the mind from every subject from. Why we ought to read Henry Miller, to the wonders of the epigrammatist Marshall, to the fine wine in the French village that he was staying at, to the texture of the prostitute's hair that he met in the village square, to the kind of spider that lived on the top of the mountain that he could see from the bunk that he was lying on while he was writing this poem, and you know, like the enormous mind linkages that belong to the world of or the universe of idealism. Ultimately, even when they're condemning war, even when they're condemning stupidity, it's he's dealing with ideals.
Well, he had tremendous ideal. He had tremendous ideal of this country, didn't he? Really, of America and of its, I think, of its possibilities, which he felt it had really not realized. And
well, I think he was more interested in a world that had no nations.
That's true. Yeah.
Chauvinistic about America with a capital A.
No.
I was talking to Murray Bookchin the other day, and I said I went to a reading by John Cage, and I said, John Cage came out against all governments, all government boundaries. And Murray said, really?
Great, yeah. Well, I've heard New Yorkers say that sort of spitefully, that the reason Rexroth came out to San Francisco on the West Coast was that he wanted to be a big fish in a little puddle, that in New York he felt that he would have been, you know, sort of subsumed in the mass of writers and artists and so on there. But do you think he had a special sort of feeling for San Francisco and for the West Coast, that it really contributed a hell of a lot to his life and to his work and to his, you know, that it was a case of deliberate choice on his part to come here and to stay here?
Well, it's obvious in all his nature poetry that he's very attached to the Western landscape and the Wild West.
I think that he had. I think he had one of the most subtle senses of the bioregion anybody I've ever come against. There's a little tiny poem that does it. I guess this is about his cabin over near the Russian River. What do you think, Lawrence? Or that one that was over near? Called Privacy. Dense fog shuts down between the hills. I step out of my cabin. You'd never know it was in the midst of a forest. Fog curls in the lighted doorway like smoke. I hear the raccoon rustling in the invisible thicket. The cool dampness creeps under my clothes. I thought I heard a car come up the road below me. I walk cautiously through the fog to the edge of the cutting. I can see nothing. Suddenly I hear, beneath my feet, a man and a woman cry out with love.
Mm.
Yeah. We were talking about his relationship with other people before. He took great risks in what he said to people and how he behaved. His poetry, though, seems to be terribly, marvelously sympathetic in the relationships that he describes. Many of these come from translations of Chinese and Japanese poetry, but I wonder if this is a natural opposite to be found in people such as Rex Roth. On the one hand, the way you behave every day at dinner or at a party, and the other way that your behavior and your thoughts are revealed in your poetry. How did you see him as a friend or as an acquaintance?
Well, for his poetry, the one word that comes to mind characterizing his poetry for me was sublimity.
Sublimity.
This is what comes through in everything Michael has just read, and in all his greatest poems, is a certain sublime tone, which he managed to get across in his own reading. His voice is gruff, and yet that was what came through for me. He was able to transcend his violent personal relationships in these poems. And Lyell's Hypothesis is a poem that has meant a lot to me, and this certainly has it. I wrote a poem many years later called Olber's Paradox, which is directly influenced by Lyell's Hypothesis. I don't know whether I should read the whole thing.
It's just two pages.
Yes, Lyell's Hypothesis again. I don't know whether I can get his tone into this, but the mountain road ends here, broken away in the chasm where the bridge washed out years ago. The first scarlet larkspur glitters in the first patch of April morning sunlight. The engorged creek roars and rustles like a military ball. Here by the waterfall, insuperable life, flushed with equinox, sentient and sentimental, falls away to the sea and death. The tissue of sympathy and agony that binds the flesh in its Nessus shirt, the clotted cobweb of unself and self, sheds itself and flecks the sun's bed with darts of blossom like flagellant blood above the water bursting in the vibrant air. This ego, bound by personal tragedy and the vast impersonal vindictiveness of the ruined and ruining world, pauses in this immortality as passionate, as apathetic as the lava flow that burned here once and stopped here and said this far and no further and spoke thereafter in the simple diction of stone. Naked in the warm April air, we lie under the redwoods in the sunny lee of a cliff. As you kneel above me, I see tiny red marks on your flanks like bites where the redwood cones have pressed into your flesh. You can find just the same marks in the lignite, in the cliff over our heads, Sequoia langsdorfi before the ice, and sempervirens afterwards. There is little difference except for all those years. Here, in the sweet moribund fetor of spring flowers, washed, flotsam and jetsam together, cool and naked together, under this tree, for a moment, we have escaped the bitterness of love, and love lost, and love betrayed. And what might have been, and what might be, fall equally away with what is, and leave only these ideograms printed on the immortal hydrocarbons of flesh and stone.
That's a magnificent poem.
Do you think that his work will be reconsidered in the near future? It seems to me that he's never been given his due generally as a poet, much as we respect him and here. When I read his poetry, so much of it comes through, so much more brilliantly than so much other poetry. I've often wondered, not being a poet and not knowing much about poetry, why he isn't more applauded, more known, more read and discussed.
Well, in the public media, who is to do the applauding that we would respect?
Anybody, everybody, somebody.
You mean the American Booksellers Association and its prizes?
Which brings us to an interesting subject.
No, that's right.
You know, I have an image, and just another change of subject here. I have an image of Kenneth. Let's see, this would go back to, I guess, it'd be 1958 is my guess. And we'd moved into a flat on Fillmore and just above Clay Street, between Clay and Washington, if I remember correctly. And it was three unbelievably high flights up to get into that flat. And we had acquired a wood-burning stove that had got to be the world's biggest and heaviest wood-burning stove. And I remember painter Ronnie Bladen and Kenneth Rexroth, among others, helping us move our possessions into that flat. And I remember Kenneth knowing how to take that stove apart, which was no simple bit of knowing, because it was, you know, it burned both wood, coal, and gas, and had a big top half hanging above it for baking, and Kenneth carrying most of that up those stairs too. And Kenneth is, and I realize now, Kenneth was then about the age I am now. And
that was before he had such a large bay window.
That's true.
He was a good cook, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
I was in his kitchen once and commanded out of it with everybody else while
the chef put together the seasoning.
A great spaghetti sauce. And it was marvelous how he could go from one kind of an orientation to another. And in his kitchen, he was someone entirely different. Mm. And at dinner, another kind of ruler. He sat and ruled over the table and commanded in the course of the conversation. Of course, why would anyone else want to talk, at least in that particular gathering?
Mike, he had a great interest in science, right?
Did you feel that very strongly? Oh, yes, if you look at his very first poem, was that the signature of all things?
Especially geology.
Yeah. Right.
Astronomy.
Uh-huh. And neurophysiology, I think, too.
Right.
He was very interested in the nervous system.
Yes, that's right.
Well, I must mention, so that this won't seem like a complete whitewash eulogy, that there was one prophecy that he was wrong about. At the very beginning of the 50s is when there were no paperback books except Old Penguins and mass market
Lawrence.
Paperbacks yeah. like Avon, which were sold in drugstores like toothpaste. And when we first had the idea to open up City Light's pocket bookshop, he told me, and I think he said it on KPFA, you could stand there by the door and give out paperback books all day long, as fast as you could give them out, and you'd still go broke and you'd never make it.
Since
then, there seem to have been a few paperback bookstores that have made it.
They did do it, didn't they? By the way, he did have for a short time his own bookstore, didn't he?
Oh, yes. Well, it went on after he had nothing to do with it for years, and it was run by Horace Schwartz, who was an old anarchist.
Right.
Originally, and whose son, Stephen Schwartz, is a brilliant young
radical
in North Beach today.
Yeah, was a bookseller. I always try to get the bookstore connection in there, you know, somewhere with a poet or a writer.
Well, Kenneth Rexroth's books continued, I believe, in the Marina District in San Francisco. He didn't have anything to do with it.
I think it was
more or less started with all his review copies, wasn't it?
I believe it was, yeah.
Horace, he had thousands.
Horace had a great affinity with review copies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
His programs were also kind of innovative. I remember at the time, remember his book review programs at KPFA?
Well, I remember because he recorded them at home, and he had a squeaky chair. We have one here tonight.
Yes, we do. And he made use of these things. You see, at that time, nobody was doing anything like that, but he felt that on the radio, he had this microphone and he had these books that we should hear exactly what's happening. We shouldn't make it sound like a studio. That was the
He was right, too.
He was right, but nobody knew at the time. He'd send the programs over, and they were full of all these extraneous sounds. You'd hear a siren. He'd do it near an open window, belches here and there, and things going on in the bathroom, whatever. And he'd let them all in.
If the phone rang, he turned off the recorder and resumed after he answered the phone.
It would drive the engineers crazy. They kept wanting to clean up the programs. And I think he knew this. And once they called up, and he says, yeah, clean it up, clean it up. And they took all of these and so on and put them all together in a little tape. It was kind of amusing. But the point was that was long before something that now people are breaking their backs to do that.
Yes,
in order to make it sound real rather than pristine and that none.
But the basic, I think the basic idea he had, which was really a wonderful idea for a book review program, was that someone was sort of engulfed in books and was just reaching in and pulling out. Gave you a wonderful sense of the whole variety of what the hell was going on in people's minds. All over the. I remember.
I watched him make one of those.
Really?
You remember his reviews?
Yeah, he literally sat back in that squeaky chair like that, and he started out with an enormous stack of books on the right on the floor, and he picked them up and he said, "I have a book here about Bronze Age China." And he'd riffle, you could hear it go, and he'd riffle through it, and he'd read you a sentence off the back, and then that would remind him of what was in it, and he'd start talking about it. And then he'd drop it on the floor, and he'd go, "Drop." And
that's right.
And he'd pick up another book from that side, and they went from the right side to the left side.
And you never knew. He went from poetry to art history to ancient history to practically political philosophy, any subject practically. I don't remember that he did very much fiction. I think he stayed.
It was mainly nonfiction.
Yeah, he stayed pretty much away from fiction.
But that was the glory of those programs. And he not just reviewed a book, he introduced you to the whole terrain within which that book was significant or meaningful in some way. And sometimes he didn't do much, but he always did that. He practically never discussed a book without giving its context, how it fit in the world. And it wasn't, I think this was just natural with him to present the synthesis or the synthetic side of things rather than analytically.
Well, you know,
he hated Carnap, for instance. I always felt he shouldn't have done that.
Yeah. Well, you were saying, Eric, that you felt that he hadn't been, you know, properly appreciated. I wonder if, as far as younger poets are concerned, he isn't perhaps very close to being, at least out here, the most influential poet. I have that sense when I talk to younger writers. Do you have that feeling?
He was very much appreciated for those recent
last
readings he gave here. For instance, the reading at the San Francisco Poetry Festival. What was that? Was that about 5 years ago? Where he did
About three years ago, where he did it
with the Koto.
We have a little section of that reading that we could play.
It's extraordinary.
If you'd like to hear it.
Have you got it on?
We have it queued up out there.
How long does it last?
Oh, it's just about 5 minutes. I queued it up because it was a nice example of the way he would introduce a poem by not just naming it, but going into the general history in the background of a.
Well, why don't we hear it, and then Michael and Lawrence can comment on it.
Yes, do you have that little section queued up?
This is The Void?
No, the other one.
No, The Japanese
School. That's
right,
okay.
Yeah.
That was our engineer at the cue board, and we hope that this is the right one.
Very patient and efficient engineer.
I'll first read my favorite Japanese poem. This is my favorite Japanese poem. The island of Awaji is, it closes the, Japanese call it the northeastern end of the Seto Sea, what Westerners call the Inland Sea. And it was the place where the two creators of the world, of the Japanese islands, stood. And formed Japan. They descended from heaven, and there was a big phallus sticking up out of the ocean, and they went around it. He went one way, and she went the other. And nothing happened. And so the gods said, no, the woman goes the other way. And finally they got it straightened out, and they created the Japanese islands. And Awaji has all kinds of meanings. I'm going to read you some of this because it will give you an idea of what complexities lie hidden in Japanese poetry. Don't think that the average professor of Japanese poetry in a Japanese university is aware of all this. But in the first place, the word translated shorebirds, and I'm going to read some poems of mine called Chidori, the tune is called Chidori, means sandpipers and plovers, and shorebirds of various kinds. And the characters mean the thousand birds. And there's a parallel, the guardians of the gate of Suma, there is a parallel with the guardian gods that are in the front of every Japanese temple, at least of certain sects, who are also the guardians of transmigration or paradise, or of mystical experience. And means that they are the cries of the shorebirds, they're weary of the cries of the shorebirds, they are weary of the souls passing to Jodo, to Amida's paradise, or to Nirvana, or to be incarnated as cockroaches or whatever. And all sorts of things happen at Suma Beach, where the guardians are. The great hero of the greatest novel in the world, the Genji Monogatari. Genji was exiled at Suma. The great romantic love poet was, his brother was exiled there, and there the Taira clan, fleeing with the infant emperor, were camped, and the great tragic hero Yoshitsune came down the mountain and drove them into the sea and almost exterminated them, and in a few months they were driven out by boat to a naval battle and were practically exterminated. So there are innumerable connections. Awaji means also never finding, and awa means spindrift or a bubble. You see how all these ideas tie together with a transitoriness of all compound things, as Buddha said. I will read the Japanese, and then I will read some poems of mine to the same melody. I have two different English versions, and I will read those first, and I'll read them too. I'll read them to music while they play the introduction, and then we'll go on. All right, Chidori. Awaji Shim Island, back and forth the shorebirds go, crying, calling. How often in the world, in the awesome night, have they awakened the guardians of Suma Barrier? Or, guardian of the gate of Suma, how many nights have you awakened at the crying of the shorebirds of the Isle of Awaji? Awaji, Shima, Kaio, Chidori, no, Nakkoeni, Ikione, Zamin, Sumano, Seiki. Now, poems of mine called.
Do you remember when that reading was given, Lawrence?
No, I don't.
It was here in San Francisco.
Oh, yes, that was at the San Francisco Poetry Festival at the Palace of Fine Arts 3 years ago, I believe.
We have.
I was still in a dream over that when you asked me the question.
I'm sorry, we had to fade out. We're going to be hearing, of course, on other prepared programs on Rex Roth, many of these readings and comments and the recollections of many other writers in the Bay Area about Rex Roth. You had a few remarks to close us off with this evening.
Well, Lawrence. It's hard to believe that Kenneth Rex Roth is gone, but I don't believe he is gone. I believe he's, at this moment, hovering over this station in the form of a great monarch butterfly dreaming it's a Chinese philosopher.
It's a beauty. That's lovely. All right.
I've heard sometimes the flapping of the wings.
Have you heard it, Michael?
Now that you mention it, yes.
Thank you very much, Michael McClure, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and Fred Cody. This evening we were paying our respects to Kenneth Rex Roth. There's much, much more to be said, and we have plenty of time to say it in the near future.
This is called Void Only, a Mahayana Buddhist idea. Time like glass, space like glass. I sit quiet, anywhere, anything happens. Quiet, loud, still, turbulent. The serpent coils on itself. All things are translucent, then transparent, then gone. Only emptiness, no limits, only the infinitely faint song of the coiling mind. Only.